welcome to episode one of Scare Zone, Halloween Horror Nights podcast. I'm your host, Logan Seculo. This week, Christopher Ripley is joining us. Next week, we're going to have on the show Scotty Too Hottie Garland. He had some tech issues, but he's going to be joining us next week. But the first week is just me and Chris, and then later on in the show, we're going to be joined by Julie Zimmerman. Do we call you Chris or Christopher Ripley?
Call me Chris. It's fine.
I can call you Chris. Okay. You heard a little bit of my backstory with Halloween Horror Nights. I've been going since 2001 was my first year. I've only missed 2 years since then due to the birth of children. I don't live in Orlando. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. We all kind of live in different areas. Scott's in Orlando. Chris spent some time in Orlando, but he'll, I'm sure, talk to you about that. But you can probably tell by his voice, doesn't reside or isn't a native Central Floridian. But we all kind of have a love for this. Like I said, I've been going since 2001. I went as the first time as just a teenager, fell in love with it, and have been going ever since. The only two times I missed, like I said, was when I had kids. One was born on October 30th, so of course I could not get away. And then we just had twins 5 months ago, and they were born. They ended up being born in November, but you know, with twins, you never knew when they were still a month early, so you never know when that was going to happen. But Chris Ripley, my friend, becoming a legend here at Halloween Horror Nights, becoming quite the historian, if you will. Chris, yeah. Why don't you tell everyone about yourself and your love for HHN?
Well, I first started going in the late 90s, 99. That was my first year. And then I've been going on and off ever since. I wrote the book. Well, the book was released last year, 2015. It took about 2 years to compile altogether, different stories and research that I had to do.
For those that don't know, what is the book? What's the book?
The book is the unofficial story and guide to Halloween Horror Nights. And it's currently being revised for 2016. I finished it, funny enough, yesterday. And it's currently with my editor and publishers who are going through it at the moment. So hopefully, yeah, that will be out. Well, they promised me before the event.
Are there big changes for this year? Are there things you need to address for people when it comes to, like, why is there a new edition? Does it just cover last year's event?
Well, it does, but also I've sort of become a bit of a pen pal with your friend, Mr. Tester.
Of course.
Yeah, and for a living, I get involved in finances and different things as well. So I'm used to dealing with statistics and things. So taking a leaf out of Len's book, I've sort of looked at patterns for last year. So sort of a busy day guide for this year, projected guide. Also, another friend of mine has helped me do some bits and bobs with our own touring plans for Halloween Horror Nights. So, you know, we've put a lot more into it in because that was the one thing that a lot of people said is we love the story part. That was great, the history.
Yeah,
but we need some more of the actual guide. And it's very difficult to do a guide when you're, as much as you want to be inside Universal, they don't really give anything away. So I can't tell you what the eight houses are this year, or the nine houses are this year, but I can do my best to give you some projections and footfall and things. So
educated guesses.
Educated guesses. Yeah. I mean, on our blog as well, HHN Unofficial, we've been taking some very big educated guesses. I mean, we broke the Penn and Teller story. Whether there will be a Penn and Teller house or what, I'm sure we'll get into it. But, yeah. You know, so at the moment it's difficult. But, yeah, so that should be coming out hopefully early summer. Funny enough, I'm not a huge horror fan. That's true. I've said this on record a few times. And in fact, in this area, in the UK, we have quite a few Halloween haunts and a few year-round ones as well. I mean, we've got a famous Saw haunted house that's at Thorpe Park that's year-round. And I don't go to any of them. I'll be honest with you, I don't. I really am just a fan of Halloween Horror Nights. So it's a bit strange, I know. But
no, I'm pretty much the same way, man. I get it. I've been a fan of Halloween Horror Nights mainly because, you know, when I first started going, I was a film school geek. And when I would go through it, it just kind of blew me away as it was this giant, you know, soundstage and giant creations that were built. It's like, I think I say it later on in the interview with Julie Zimmerman we have coming up. It's like a giant art installation. And I kind of fell in love with that. I do like scary movies. Not necessarily the more recent stuff. I love the stuff from the kind of campy horror from the 70s and 80s and even some of the 90s. I don't like the like over the top, just gross to be gross, disturbing to be disturbing. I started watching, I know we're going to talk about the First House announcement, but I started watching, I won't even say what, I know everyone who's listening to this knows, the First House is obviously Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I haven't watched that since I was like 13, or it was probably, I was too young to watch it then. I was like, I'm going to watch it and see. I got like 20 minutes in, and it was like, okay, not at 11 o'clock at night. I'll watch this at another time. Those films in general, but I'm not, hey, I literally an hour ago walked out of the Jungle Book, and that was intense enough for me. And that 3D alone, I was, you know, jumping from Ka and all, you know, whatever. It is what it is. But I do love the idea of some of these, you know, classic attractions, or not classic attractions, but these intellectual properties being presumed. I love the originals. The originals are at my heart. I think when I started going to Halloween Horror Nights was kind of in that heyday of Jack the Caretaker, all of those classic kind of the icons they brought back last year were kind of in my, like, that's my formative years in the park, were those the storyteller, all those classic characters. And I do have that as a love. But as we did see, the First House was announced, and it was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which has been a house, you know, previously, sort of. But why don't we go, Chris, you know, sort of the more of the history side of this. What's it looking like? What are your thoughts in general about Texas Chainsaw Massacre being the first house announced? And then what does it look like? Because it's been part of the past as well.
It has, yeah. I mean, the last time we saw Leatherface officially was in 2007. Although I'm quick to point out that house was based on the remake that was released that year or the year after, whenever it was. So we haven't had an actual house based off the original movie. Never. Well, Leatherface has appeared unofficially, inverted commas, if Universal lawyers are listening closely. the other thing is, a lot of people, the real Haunt fans, have moaned slightly because he has appeared in other haunts around the country, and not at Universal in Orlando. And he has appeared several times in Hollywood. So, you know, there's a bit of a history there.
Yeah. Yeah. What are your general thoughts on this as the first announcement? I honestly, you know, I was expecting a little bit something when they didn't really build it up, but the fact we're still, this is only April and we're getting house announcements. I was expecting maybe a little something more, maybe that Penn and Teller announcement. But what are your thoughts on having Leatherface and the classic, the 70s Texas Chainsaw?
Well, I mean, I remember, I don't remember every house, but I do remember the 2007 house, and it was in the earthquake queue. And that sort of building is kind of outdoors, kind of indoors, isn't it, that one?
Yeah.
Well, it was until they demolished it. And it had that airy kind of country kind of feel to it. And there was quite a bit of space in there. So at the end, when he chased you out of the house, they had all the sheets up like they had in the film. And it kind of felt like you were bang smack right in the middle of that film. And it was quite good. And Mike has said that the house will be in one of the sprung tents. So this year they're going to go for the more confined, claustrophobic element of the film. So they're going to go for a real different take. So if you do remember it from 2007, it should, in theory, be completely different.
So we just got the first announcement, obviously, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It does seem early, but is this sort of what we should expect now? Is it because of the fandom? I feel like before I would check in like in August and I'd get our new updates.
Well, it varies every year. I think the current pattern at the moment is to start around now and do one a month. So
okay, so we're a couple of weeks out, you think, from house number two?
I would imagine so, yeah.
So, Chris, before we get to our interview with Julie, I did want to ask you, so what are the, you know, the Penn and Teller rumors kind of started quite a bit. When did you guys break that?
Back in February we broke that.
That's what I thought. I've been hearing about it for a while now. So what is the kind of current standing with that, and what do you think we're actually going to get? Are we going to get a stage show? Are we going to get a house? A little bit of both?
I don't know in answer to your question. I'll tell you where it started from. I am literally going to Vegas in September for a short vacation. And like Disney or Universal or whatever, I like to plan. Sure. We all do. And so I like to plan my Vegas trip. And I went on to the Rio Resort website to try and book a time to see the show for Penn & Teller. And the dates weren't up. And a bit strange, before they've always been up, so why aren't they up this year? The only time I could remember them not being up was when Penn & Teller were, funny enough, at Halloween Horror Nights last time.
So it
sprung from there. I rung the resort. They wouldn't tell me. I then did some investigation, looked on Twitter and some other different sources and spoke to some people. And then I published the rumor. And then people started sending me stuff they'd found on the internet as well. So it kind of snowballed from there. So I don't know. I mean, Penn & Teller at the moment, I mean, in the UK, they're really popular. They've got a show over here, Fool Us. I'm sure you see it over there. It might not be Halloween Horror Nights. They might be trying to get rid of Fear Factor or something. I don't know, but
I'd love to see it. I mean, it would be awesome. The fact that I told my buddy Will, who's on the other show with me on WDW Today, I was like, yeah, there's this rumor that Penn & Teller may be doing like even a potential nightly, you know, show like Brian Bushwood did, or we joked around about when a Lizard Man was just in line for. Felt like no reason, but he was there. You know, it was like, it would be awesome to have that kind of live entertainment, especially that kind of like headliner entertainment as part of Halloween Horror Nights. More in the house. The house was fun. I you know, what is odd, and I think you kind of said it, Chris, I'm sure Scott probably would agree, is that, you know, your nights can get a little blurry at Halloween Horror Nights. It gets a little.
Yeah.
So unlike when we're talking Disney, I could be like, oh yeah, that was this ride at this moment or whatever. Or even if I'm talking Universal daytime, but for Halloween Horror Nights, I'm like, it is kind of like, oh yeah, that was in 2009. I don't remember where. It's all a blur. And it was just a blast. Because who knows, you're having a good time, you're eating, you're drinking, you're making your way through. And it just, you know, sometimes I don't even know what house I end up in. I'm like, wait, what's happening? It's just it's an adventure.
Do you find that other than last year, the 2 or 3 years before are all a bit of a blur? Do you find that?
Yeah, I do. But I think it was just mainly because of that lack of icon and so on. But still lots of fun. It's nothing against it, but it did feel a little bit like one big event, which, you know, may not be a negative.
Yeah.
But like things pop in my head, like, oh yeah, like those giant baby heads.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's kind of how it feels. Like it's like moments more than it is necessarily telling you what the houses were. Just like, oh yeah, then the Purge was in the streets. I remember that. Like, and then it's like, okay, and then what did we do after that? It's like, I don't know, we went to Moe's. I don't really remember. And you see now, people are obviously there's certain people that are for this Texas Chainsaw Massacre house, or people that are against it. People are against things being kind of regurgitated again, except for. That one exception seems to be Jack. Jack seems to be okay all year round.
Well, the thing is, they had the Entertainer Designer Forum recently, and the guy that plays Jack, James Keaton, and Chance was the lady that plays Chance. They were there on stage, and that's probably the first time, my knowledge, that Universal has let two of their actors out and say, "Look, this is who we play," and they kind of celebrated that. You know, I think that was great, and for them and for everybody, you know, or the fans particularly. So in my opinion, and we did start the hashtag, you know, bring back Jack. So let's bring back Jack.
I can't agree more. I actually was speaking with him via Twitter earlier today. Hopefully we can get him on the show. I think you're right. I think Universal is a little protective, and they should be, of those characters. So we'll see. We'll see when we get there. We have a lot of people coming up, guys, if you're interested. Obviously, today's show, we're going to have Julie Zimmerman, who is one of the creators of Halloween Horror Nights back in the 90s. Created Bill and Ted, created all these classic attractions, a lot of things you guys still know of. And then later on, we're going to have on Jason Sorrell, who, you know, among many things, wrote quite a few of the Bill and Ted shows, produced them. He's now working back at Universal Creative, so we're going to have him on probably on the next episode. So we'll have lots of guests coming up. I'm sure people that work behind the scenes, as we've seen this community grow. Now, Chris, how do you feel about that? Have you seen this? I do feel like in the last few years, it has went from a community that was a little bit more like, oh yeah, a lot of people go every year, but now to see this sort of group growing.
Yeah, I mean, in years past, it was a very tight-knit, small fan base, small community, if you like. And I think what with the event growing to how much it has, and I think also with social media now, with Facebook and everything else, it's kind of opened up. And it's much, much larger. I mean, the other day when Texas Chainsaw was announced, Halloween Horror Nights was trending worldwide. I mean, to my knowledge, I don't ever remember that happening. So,
and that was just for a house announcement and not something that's like, I mean, like Texas Chainsaw, yes, great, but it's not like it's we didn't get Penn and Teller. You know, we didn't get something that's going to be, should make national news. You know, we got that is just sort of like, oh, they've just started, in all actuality, they've just really just started announcing stuff for the event and it took off.
Yeah, it's very interesting times.
The Disney fan base, that Halloween Horror Nights and Universal even was almost like a four-letter word. Couldn't say Halloween Horror Nights or Universal without someone kind of going, oh, yeah, we don't ever go over there. We leave that to itself. Now it does seem like, even when we're taking questions on WDW Today, I get a lot of, how do I get to Universal? What's the best way to get there? Even if I'm staying at Disney, how do I got to go? And a lot of that is attributed to Harry Potter, obviously. Like, that changed the game. And it changed the game for me. I I'm a Universal like grad. I worked for Nickelodeon there when it was still Nickelodeon Studios, Florida. I love Universal. But I do have to say that Harry Potter edition changed it for me from, man, I really love this, to, man, these guys are doing it so insanely well. And Halloween Horror Nights was already great, and I was already going for years, but it's even been kicked up since then. But I think you have seen this swell of fan base, this swell of people talking about Halloween Horror Nights. Their social media has been great when it comes to leaking information to people, tweeting, getting involved, whether it's Mike personally being involved and telling people what's happening. And we're going to be covering everything Halloween Horror Nights here on Scare Zone. We're talking not just what's going on this year, rumors and all that. And we had fun talking about that today. But even in this interview, we're going to go back in time, back to 91 or 89 even, I think it does, in this interview, and talk about the history. So we're going to cover the past, present, and future of Halloween Horror Nights, from the people who created it, the people that lived it, from former characters to current people that are involved in the production of Halloween Horror Nights. You think it feels like a good time to go to our interview with Julie? I think that's a yes. I'll take that as a yes. We're still working the kinks out with that. Here's our interview with Julie Zimmerman, one of the creators of Halloween Horror Nights. So for our listeners that maybe don't know, you know, prior to Fright Nights, what was your role at Universal Studios?
I was a project coordinator on three shows. I started in Hollywood on the Florida Project in 1987, when there were, 12 people working on it, and eventually then I moved over to, I worked for Peter Alexander at that time. I was his secretary. Peter was the vice president of shows and special effects. And after about a year with him, I said, can I go work on Florida and be a coordinator? He said, yes. So I worked on Murder, She Wrote, Animal Actors, and Alfred Hitchcock, The Art of Making Movies.
Oh, yeah,
that's
classic.
How I started. Yeah, and they sent me to Florida with the guys. It was just me and the guys at that time. And then eventually I decided I would stay, because we were all could go back to L.A., but the cost of living was so much better. And I realized I had better career opportunities by staying in Florida. And that's how I stayed.
That's great. Now, you know, it's 1991, only, you know, a year or so, year and a half after the park opens.
Right.
What happened to spur this idea? You're credited as one of the co-creators of what became Halloween Horror Nights, Fright Nights at the time. Do you have an early memory of what was the first concept? How did it start? How did this thing come into your mind?
It was Jay Stein, though. The Halloween, well, the first Fright Nights was really, you know, Jay Stein, who was the head of everything in those days with Florida. Jay had always wanted to do like a haunted house at Universal Hollywood. They had done a sort of Fright Nights before, but they had a terrible accident, so they stopped it. So Jay's the one that wanted to do this. So I was just coming off of doing some work I had rewritten the Ghostbuster attraction. I had done some work on that. And so I was sort of in between. And they came to me from the entertainment department and they said, you're from planning and development. We really need a project manager on this thing called Fright Nights. And I said, sure. And so they knew I knew things that the entertainment department then didn't, which was I had come from, you know, an environment of art directors and drawings. You know what I'm saying. So I went and did the project management on that first one, because they were kind of floundering in certain areas. You know, how do we get Beetlejuice to come out of the ground by the Bates Motel, which, of course, that was the beginnings of the Graveyard Review, which then became a show there. So,
right, which lasted till just recently. I mean, some of these things you put in place lasted for, still are going.
That show, I mean, Fright Nights was usually successful. So, I mean, that's one of the first times I ever saw Jay Stein smile. I remember one day we were, you know, because it was, they had no clue. You don't know if people are really going to come. That Dungeon of Terror was still the scariest haunted house I've ever been in my life. You know, they had Paul Revere and the Raiders as a band. I mean, it was well put together. in things for people to do, but Universal wasn't sure if they were going to commit to money. So I was literally, I was over in the planning and development trailer in between gigs again, because at that point I was not really belonged to anybody. And Rich Costales, who was the head of operations at the time, said, "What would you do for Halloween?" And I sat there at my little computer and I wrote down what I would do for Halloween, which was do a show called Bill and Ted's Excellent Halloween Adventure, because I realized, oh, what a great way to do whatever we want to, you know, do a haunted house in a soundstage, do this, do that. And I turned it all in, never heard a word from them. And then one day, literally, I got a call and they go, "Okay, we're going to have a Halloween." And I was the only person working on Halloween at the time.
Fun.
And that's when I called you. Yeah, I called John Paul and I said, "Oh my God, you've got to come help." And then Tony Pugh, who was another planning and development person who was at the time working there, I said to the entertainment department, "And you've got to get a really good project manager on this." And that's how Halloween Horror Nights began. I literally wrote Halloween Horror Nights concept on a card table, you know, a little folding table and a borrowed computer in a trailer, never knowing it was going to happen. And that's how that became Halloween Horror Nights.
That's unbelievable to hear that, especially as you start, like, yeah, even things like the Bill and Ted Show, which are now just iconic pieces of the entire,
yep,
experience. I mean, to,
yep,
me,
yep,
as a kid, when I went to Halloween Horror Nights the first time as a early teen, that was sort of my entryway to it. I was, you know,
yeah,
the idea of Halloween Horror Nights freaked me out, but in a great way, but the idea of going to see Bill and Ted was something that was so exciting.
It was the best.
Because, you, yeah, know, those were like my heroes. So to see them. And
I love them too.
Yeah. And maybe we're going to get a third movie. That's what they're talking about. Were you a fan of horror and the idea of being scared? Is that something you liked, or is it just you were assigned a job?
No.
And you did your best?
No, it was just that, you know, I came out of a great training ground. I mean, when I worked for Peter Alexander as his secretary, I went to all the meetings with Steven Spielberg, so to take notes.
Oh,
so here I am, right? I mean, I'm from Sandusky, Ohio originally. So here's this girl from Sandusky, Ohio. And, you know, I'm going to all these meetings with my boss, who is wonderful, with Steven Spielberg. So I'm taking notes.
That's unreal.
I mean, it's unreal. You know, I got Christmas presents from his office and everybody would look at me because it'd be like, "You're going with Peter to the meeting with Steven Spielberg." I said, "I'm taking notes." So, I mean, how can you not? I was around the best. And I came out of, you know, that's a true story. It's hysterical.
It's unbelievable. I mean, that's to just say that that's, I mean, to accomplish what you accomplished and what you still continue to do, but to start as even just being in those meetings alone, just being the fly on the wall or taking the notes.
It was fabulous. And those two were friends. You know, they went to college together, so they had a very good relationship. And so, you know, it was just, Peter was that kind of guy. You know, he would take me over to the back lot and we'd go here and there. But so there I am sitting there with the two of them talking about the Lagoon show, you know, the famous first Lagoon show.
Sure.
And Spielberg saying to Peter, "I don't know about you," he said, "but I really like what they do at Disneyland at the end when they have fireworks and everybody's happy and you guys want to kill everybody and blow them up."
Very true.
And then the last one, he didn't say that though. And then he goes, "Maybe I just don't know how to have fun." And I thought, oh my gosh. But that's how I learned, because Peter also, I read everything that came in, because Peter didn't really read all the scripts for all the things that were coming in for Florida. So I started reading it all. And you sort of, you know, you get all this into your DNA. And I was around all the cool art directors in Hollywood that in those days are, you know, the guys that worked with Alfred Hitchcock. So all the cool things we got to do there, it just sort of translated. And there I was in Florida and they're asking me this stuff. So I thought, well, okay.
That is crazy. I mean, I did some research and tried to read up on some interviews with you, but most of them related to Halloween Horror Nights or to Fright Nights,
right,
were very, right, much in the vein of, like, in the early 90s, talking about, you know, really the experience people are going to have, not really your background. This is the first I've heard of that.
No.
So we have to bring you on again to talk about all of those situations, because that is just
a great story.
That's,
yeah,
just great. That's just so exciting.
It's a true story. I mean, people still, they laugh at me when they say, "Well, how did you do this?" I said, "Well, they asked me to do it. And, you know, I had really nowhere to sit because I was in between. I was making $12 an hour."
Right.
I have to tell you that, because at that point I had gone down to literally being an hourly employer, making $12 an hour, working on borrowed equipment. And then it became this huge thing. And I remember Rich Costales said to me after Bill and Ted, "Where are you going to go now?" You know, I mean, it was hysterical, because it was like, there's this one woman in a trailer And what I did with Bill and Ted, they're Jason Sorrell, who I think is back at Universal
He's
Creative.
He's back, yeah, back at Universal.
He was a great young writer who used to constantly come to me and say, you know, I want to work for you, I want to work for you. So I gave him, you know, like the third year Bill and Ted to write, and Jason really turned it around because he's a brilliant writer. But you can do anything, you know, and we could do, and you know, the thing that was so funny, we never knew what our budget was that second year. I didn't know how much money I really had to spend or what we could do. We just sort of went with God, and everything just blossomed.
And it did become almost, I mean, the one thing that I really love about the whole experience of Halloween Horror Nights, not only does it just transform the park, is it, for me, as someone who is genuinely a creative person, I've worked in film and television as well and worked in this, obviously now doing podcasting, is it does feel like this giant, almost art installation that is unreal to walk through. If you walk through as a person who want to be scared, great. But if you walk through with the mindset of, look at these sets, look at what's built, look at the acting that's happening, it's mind-blowing to see it happen a thousand times a night.
Yep. Well, in the first year, we were in a borrowed trailer, of course, because everything was, again, we had nothing. We had nowhere to go for Fright Nights. We were in a trailer that used to be with the Fievel show, and I had one telephone in there. It was a wall phone. And so all the, which I eventually named characters, were in there with us. But in those days, we didn't send them out with an escort. So they'd go out, and they'd come back, and they'd say to me, I'm not going out there again.
I'm not getting punched.
Because they're getting killed, you know. Yeah. I mean, that first year we learned a lot, and from then on, you know, we treated differently. But they literally would come back in the trailer, and they'd be like, please don't make me go. And just hysterical things like, how do we give breaks for the Dungeon of Terror? How do we feed them? I mean, we were stealing food from the restaurants to feed the cats. We were crazy.
This was not a priority for Universal year one. This was just, they wanted to see what would happen.
They had to do it because Jay wanted to do it, you know, and because you have to remember that theme park opened so badly.
Right.
And, you know, they're trying to get their footing into this. And they were looking for, I believe, you know, something to be events that they can have. And I mean, it was really Jay who drove it because he wanted to do it. So Universal sort of could care less. You know, they're kind of like, okay. And then when it became the next year, again, they have to commit to money. And that theme park was still fixing rides. You know, we were in the Jaws 2 line for 2 years with Halloween. So it's like, you know, you have a thing that's costing you millions, and here we are, these crazy people want to do this event. And of course, we needed money to do it. So, you know, I never knew until it became more of a marquee event, then we were safe.
Yeah, no, you can't imagine. It's today, you know, if you're part of the Halloween Horror Nights community today, you know, we're now recording this in, you know, mid-April, and they're announcing the first houses today. So obviously times have grown and people have obviously got to embrace this thing. And there's a whole community behind it. It's what we're talking to. So it's fun to hear that it came from, in some ways, humble beginnings, you know, just from you in a trailer coming up with ideas. Did they give you, now they give you access, because I've been watching some videos from the first years, or especially that first year from 91, did they give you access to the IPs, to the intellectual properties? Were there things off base, on base, or was it just have fun, see what you come up with?
We were able to, I mean, of course, we had the rights to any Universal monster there was, right? But we broke every law there was in the beginning. I mean, there's some of the things which you know, in those days, I mean, we had one of the best characters we had was from The Exorcist. We had a guy dressed as a priest, and we had Reagan on the bed, and he rolled the bed around, and it scared everybody. Well, they got a letter in the legal department about that right away. It was like, in those days, we just were rogue. And so we got letters about that. We got letters about Freddy Krueger, you know, in those days. I mean, we did get properties for Bill and Ted. We weren't that bad. But just about everything else, some of the characters running around there, you know, the legal department would call and they go, is it true that you had the guy dressed as the Terminator in Bill and Ted Show?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that is.
And I said, yeah, we did.
It's parody. But, come on.
You know, that. Yeah, we did. But then now they're so, I mean, everybody probably wants to be them. In those days, you just never knew. They were just like, is it true that you have the Lost Boys running around the theme park? I said, yes, we do have people dressed as the Lost Boys.
And they see that still happen this year. I mean, I think this past year there was supposed to be a Scream house based on Scream, and they scrapped it and changed it last week.
Oh, did they?
I forgot even what they changed it to, but they had to. So if you walked through knowing, like a lot of the uber nerds like us on the that know about what's going on, knowing that it was Scream, was clearly like the Scream house that they had adjusted to fit. I forget what was it with the final one. So you are seeing those still those issues of getting through that intellectual property as time moves on.
Sure.
But that's fun to hear that it almost was operating like a mom and pop haunted house. It was like, yeah, we'll throw the Scream guy up. Yeah, we'll throw the Terminator out there. Who cares? Let's just see what happens when it is this massive park.
Yeah, I mean, we were writing, or we're creating what we thought would scare people and what would be cool for Bill and Ted. You know, what can we do in those days? Or what can we do with the characters walking around the park? And it was just, you know, people had great ideas. And it was like, okay, we'll put it out there. You know, and it started and we'll see what happens. Now, the People Under the Stairs, which came for the second year, that, of course, was a Universal film. So we would look for, like, Dr. Giggles was a Universal film. So if we were taking certain portions to put in certain haunted houses in those days, we did get it cleared that way. Yeah, we didn't play. I mean, you know, you can only do something bad a couple times for the legal department. You know, they know you by name. They used to call me up and they'd say, Julie, this is Tony Faber. That's what he used to say to me.
Yep.
And I'd think, oh, what did I do now?
You mentioned that the Dungeon of Terror, which was the first big house.
Oh, God help us.
What was that like building that out, and that whole process of putting together, you know, because some of the other experience was more like shows and events and, you know, like I said, Beetlejuice. But to build out a haunted house when your background wasn't necessarily in that, what was that like?
Well, it was, you know, you had guys that were Kim Scipioli and Joel House, who were guys that stayed with Universal for a while. You know, these guys had the creative for it, and we had the Jaws Q line. So remember, again, in those days, now, even when I was there, of course, we went through a lot more with, you know, because I brought in all the drawings and the approvals. But in those days, it was sort of like, okay, here it is, and we're going to make this room, and we're going to make that room. It was, you know, and the guys all hung out together. I mean, there's a great team in those days. I mean, all the guys that were there had all been there when the park opened. So you had, you know, we had guys working on things. Their names was like Dog. God's name was Dog. I mean, we had the bizarre group, but these guys worked so hard. So, you know, the Dungeon of Terror, probably what made it was so scary that we probably broke a few laws because it was so dark in that house. It scared you half to death. You know, of course, that's the first year we had the rats and the rat lady.
Of course.
And
still a staple,
you know,
26 years later.
Yeah. I mean, we had stuff in there and, you know, we just sort of pushed the boundaries of everything you could. But it was really thought out. Those guys knew where to put the scares. And I learned from that house myself. But I did know the lucky thing about me being in planning and development. I was from the beginning of all the, you know, the drawings and everything to do the three attractions I worked on. So thank God I had some background so I could understand. And then as I grew in my role, you know, I had more expertise and I had friends still that worked in what is now called Universal Creative. But then, you know, they were all guys I worked with before. So I'd call them if I had a problem. But I hired people that knew what they were doing to draw and help design the houses. I'd say, let's do this, you know, and they'd put it together. Then we had the Adopt-a-Rat program. Course, because the big thing with the rats were, you know, well, we have to adopt the rats out, and I don't know if they still do it. So we had an adoption program.
I don't believe so. Hold on, for those of us that don't know, because I've seen the Rat Lady now, you know, however many times, 17 times I've been to Halloween Horror Nights. But
right.
What about what was the Adopt a Rat program?
Well, we would have people just, you know, kind of how when you go and you want to get a new pet, they'd come to us, and we tell them if they could have one of the rats from Halloween or not. I mean, we literally had people adopt the rats.
Oh, and so at the end of the run, so you'd acquire the rats. And at the end of the run, you would, you know, be able to get one of the rats, one
adopt
of the now
rat
famous
program.
Rats. So for real, they could. It wasn't part of the attraction.
No, we just had people in the, you know, that worked there in different places. And, you know, we decided, well, we're going to be humane to these rats. We always were anyway.
Sure, yeah, of course.
And so we decided we would have a, you know, do you want to adopt a rat program? So they all went to good home.
I don't know why in my mind the rat lady just came with the rats. I always kind of thought, you know, she's the rat lady.
No, they had to audition for that. That was a big audition point for us. You had to audition to be the rat lady. And the first year, she begged us to go into that coffin. I mean, she's like, please let me be a rat lady. And I'm like, go for it, girl.
Yeah, have fun.
No. So, you know, that first year. So the rats lived with us in the trailer when they weren't at the dungeon. And then one year, believe it or not, we had nowhere to put the rats. We put them in the back of what, remember the earthquake attraction that's gone, but we had the raft in there. So none of the people knew that in back of that one whole deal where they show you, you know, how we make movies, there was this huge cage of rats in there. So I'd go every day and feed the rats. So,
you never know what's going on right behind that corner
at a theme park. And, you know, we had stuff happen where, you know, a snake would get loose. We had snakes one year, and I'd get these calls from tech service, and they'd go, there's a snake on Hollywood Boulevard. I'd go, okay.
Right.
They'd get out.
Very fun.
There's a tarantula inside Mel. You know, I mean, hysterical stuff, and we just would kind of go with the flow. Okay, we'll come get him.
Yeah, you just tell people it's part of the show. Come on, come to Halloween Horror Nights, or come to Friday Nights.
You know the Robosaurus story of the first year? Have you ever heard that one? Because when Robo came, what we did?
No, please, go ahead.
Well, I got it. I love Robosaurus, and my boss is the one who loved it. He wanted this thing more than God itself. So, you know, we're going to do this show, and of course we had to acquire all these old cars, because Robo eats a car, and make sure that all the gas is out and there's no oil so we don't start a big fire. So, unfortunately, somebody didn't check on the one car. And it still had some fuel in it. So when Robo picked it up, the thing caught on fire when he breathed fire. And then when he dropped it, the street caught on fire.
Oh, where was he placed at this moment?
This is right over there by the, you know, in front of the New York Public Library there, in front of the Daily Planet. So we called 911 because basically Universal Studios Florida is on fire. Mm-hmm. And the people thought it was part of the show.
The show, yeah.
Yeah, and they were like, the fire department's coming in and all this is going on, and the people are coming up to me, and they're saying, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. How did you do that?
It seems like they burnt the place down.
Fire? They literally burnt the street. We burnt the street. The street was in flames. We had to call the Orlando Fire Department.
There was
a cloud of smoke. It was hysterical. Yeah. I mean, it was like this huge plume was coming. We set the thing on fire. And, I mean, you had to get somebody. So the fire department just literally, and then the fire department's trying to figure out how to get into Universal Studios. You know what I'm talking about with the different gates?
Sure, yeah.
Oh, and I'm just standing there thinking, well, here we go. But
we set fire at Nickelodeon. It's always fun back when it was still there, it was always fun to work our way through everything. I love this sort of vision that I'm having of Universal in the early 90s being, it's almost like the Wild West. It was, you know, it's just whatever.
We would drive around in golf carts, you know, in the middle of the night because we were there all the time, day and night. We were always in trouble. I mean, we were like little kids in trouble where my boss would call me and go, Julie, I just got a call from security. They said you were driving too fast without your lights on in the golf cart. I said, I'll tell the guys. We were always in trouble for something. But eventually, we all made great friends with tech services because we always had to pay them thousands of dollars because we ruined property. I mean, we had to pay for that street.
Of course. A major causeway within the park is up in flames. How long did you work on the attraction at Universal? How many years?
I was with Universal 10 years from, I think it was 96 when I left. And then I ended up, funny as it is, I ended up freelance for them on some of the things for Japan. And then I ended up coming back just to work on some props for Twister. And then I went to work for one of my vendors, believe it or not, after that. And then they did, I worked for a place called Bright House, which is no longer here anymore. But then they did some work and I did some work with them on Universal Japan. So to me, I never left them for many years. They were still part of, you know, in my blood. But,
now, you were obviously there for the first year. Is there any particular moment? I know we've obviously gone through a lot now already. Is there any particular moment, any favorite part of even what the guests got to experience? Not necessarily behind the scenes, but was there a favorite part of a show or was it the dungeon that was your favorite part of that first year?
Well, I think my favorite part of the dungeon of terror was the asylum. That was the scariest thing because it was built in such a way, and, you know, you had in crazy people in there and they had the Hannibal Lecter character in there and it was like you couldn't get away from them. You'd make a right turn and somebody would come at you. You'd make another turn and they'd come at you. That was I used to just absolutely go crazy when someone said, will you take me into the house? I was like, I really don't want to go because I was so afraid.
That is,
and we had the,
and you were one of the people that made it and you were still, you know, shocking. Was there any worry about that the attraction would be too intense for the audience because you were building something new. People thought of Universal Studios at the time, like you said, it was kind of fledgling, but starting to kind of kick back up. And that's, I believe, the first year I visited as a kid was in around 91, was around the 91, 92. Did you see, you know, that experience when you guys were mapping it out, or was it just go full on and see what happens? Or was there an attention to knowing the guests may not know?
No, we weren't worried about that. I mean, we were trying to create the most interactive guest experience that we could. I mean, you know, in those early days, I mean, now it's a little different, but especially when we started training the characters how to follow people and such. I mean, my goal was to just scare the stuff out of people because that was my job, you know? And right. So I figured, you know, if you're going to come to something that is Halloween Horror Nights or Fright Nights, you've got to scare them. I had been to Knott's Scary Farm. You know, we had traveled all over the United States looking at the thing, and I'm like, oh, please, you know, we're going to tear this up. So, you know, our goal was to try to come up with the goriest, the scariest, the coolest. So it's a combo plate, you know, so you've got a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But I was not worried about, I just wanted them to be scared to death, basically. That was my job.
And that's changed some now. You know, I don't know if you've, have you been to, and when was the last time you went to a Halloween Horror Nights?
Oh, I when I left, I never went back to Halloween because it was sort of like, you know, that was, you know, it's like your kid.
Yeah, you put it behind you. Yeah.
You put it behind you, you know, you move on with your life and you just don't go. So, you know, my daughter has gone. My daughter's 19 now. But, you know, I kind of like a part of all of us keep it in our heart. And I kind of hate to, first of all, I don't wait in line for anything. So if I had to wait in line for any attraction, I'd probably, you know, collapse. But I know I have. It's absurd. Yeah.
It's if you don't, you know, pay for the extra special extreme pass, you're waiting in line. I mean, you're not going to see most of it the day you go. And that is what's kind of changed. I feel like I love the attraction now. I loved it when I first went. But there is a bit of it that the scare level, the attention to detail is still there and it's still beautiful. And the artwork is insane. But the scare level is maybe not as much there because there's so many people. And there's so much to do that you wait in line for 4 hours and you're literally touching people as you walk through an attraction. But you do still live in the Orlando area. And as we start to, you know, wrap this up for you, because I know you have a busy day ahead of you, you live in the Orlando area. You obviously see, you know, the billboards and you see it still happening.
Oh, yeah, I see everything.
Is there a part of you that feels, you know, pride knowing 26 years later, this is going to be Halloween Horror Nights 26. Leatherface is just announced, someone that was in your first few years. And that's a big thing. People are excited. Leatherface is here. I'm like, well, Leatherface was there in Halloween Horror Nights 1.
I have great pride. I mean, I literally, you know, when I tell people and they say, when I say I created Halloween Horror Nights and they think you're lying, right? But I said, I just go back to the story of sitting on that card table. So I have great, tremendous, and I loved Universal. My time there was the greatest time of my life. You know, there's no doubt in my, what I was able to do in my career at that point with those people, because I loved them. I don't know much about that place anymore, but I, you know, Tom Williams was so kind to me, to everyone there. You know, they were Rich Castell, so supportive of what we did. But what I do is every time I go to a movie or see certain things, I think about where I would put that segment into Halloween Horror Nights. I can't help myself. You know what I'm saying? I think, oh, this would really be great on, because I'll never stop thinking about it. Because it was, you know, we planned it year round. So it was a lot of my life. It was my child. Yeah, it was my gory child, but it was more fun than you could have in a lifetime. I mean, nobody could have a job like I did. And then if, you know, something was funky with our day, we'd go ride Back to the Future, which of course is also gone, but can you not?
Yeah. Fun lunch break ride. Take a break, get your day back in order. Did you know, and we can start to again, wrap it up. I know you got to go, but did you know that it was going to be, did you know it was going to be a hit, or did you know, when did you know that, all right, this thing is not only going to last this year, but potentially could be the flagship event for Universal?
Because of the reaction from the people. I mean, you couldn't, you couldn't not. Yeah, I mean, I knew this was a keeper. And this was, what I knew about Universal, which I loved about us, we were so different than, you know, People with Mice and Happiness. You know, Universal to me was always an adult place. So to me, it was just like, this is the perfect place. And I never doubted it. I did Mardi Gras. I mean, I did planning for Universal that went out 20 years. So I had all the things in my day, you know, I was telling them, do Macy's Parade, do all this, because it was sort of like, you know, we were given such freedom creatively at that time. So I always knew it was going to be successful. People love Halloween. It's sort of bigger than Christmas for a lot of people. And, you know, it's I knew it was going to be a gold mine for them, because that first year when they came out of that, if you've ever seen any of that footage, they came out of that Dungeon of Terror, they were crying, screaming, and you know, I just knew it was a winner for Universal. It fit them. You know, if you go back to the history of the studio, what was Universal, what saved them were the horror films.
Right. It was a perfect fit for that entire experience, yeah. Whether it was the writing the movies or whether it was experience, it fit perfect with the Universal theming. It still fits and still great. And, you know, for me, talking to you has been just a pleasure to hear these stories. Because, I see it, and all of us see it for the most part. I mean, I worked at Nickelodeon when it was there for a few years, so I was able to see just characters walking around and, you know, taking a break. But I was never able to really fully immerse myself in the creative process. So to hear how it started, look, whoever has that card table has the most valuable Universal collectible.
There you have it. And it was a borrowed Mac computer. I mean, and then he called me when I was over in the trailer, and he goes, I need it back. And I'm like, okay, fine. it's hysterical, but it was great. And you know, I loved it. I mean, I loved it. And I loved the things we created with those characters. But yeah, I mean, the stories of what really went down are the best part of Halloween Horror Nights. I mean, if, you know, people don't realize that this huge thing started out and the things that it is now. I mean, it's great. But that I give Universal credit for allowing an event like that to happen. I do. I mean, I think what they do still is the best in theme park entertainment. So, you know, God bless them all.
Halloween Horror Nights is certainly a flagship for everyone, but yeah, to hear those stories here, and you know what, that it adds credibility to me even more so that the experience of creating it that first year wasn't this corporate idea of, yes, there was obviously someone going, we should do Halloween Horror Nights or we should do a Halloween thing, but it was this very natural thing that you guys built that felt grassroots, felt like I said, almost like the Wild West. And to hear that, it just makes me even more excited for, you know, what has happened in the past and what's to come. And hopefully we'll talk to people who work on it still, that kind of experience is still happening. I have no idea now that, you know, NBC or Comcast, whoever it is control, you know, what they allow them to do, what they don't allow them to do. But to hear that those initial experiences were like that, Julie, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Oh, my pleasure. No, my pleasure. I mean, like I said, it's a great thing. It's part of my life. It will always be part of my life.
Well, we appreciate it, Cam. More. Is there any way? I mean, I know you work obviously still in the Orlando area. This is just
I'm at the Orlando Ballet. That's where I work now.
Well, how can people? I guess then is there? Would you want to plug the Orlando Ballet for people that would like to see that?
Well, I'm, you know, the Orlando Ballet is fabulous, as we know, and I work actually. I'm the manager of the Orlando Ballet School.
Oh, very good.
So we have three schools, and I work the main one in Princeton, but Orlando Ballet, people should go see. Dr. Phillips, Beauty and the Beast is coming up, and if you'd love to have your child have a great dance education, then come on down, because we have one of the best schools practically in the United States, Orlando Ballet School. Fabulous.
Thank you. We'll link that in our show notes. Thank you so
much. Thank you, my darling.
All right, I think that's going to do it for episode one of Scare Zone, Halloween Horror Nights podcast. Thanks to Chris Ripley. Next week on the show, Scott Garland's going to be joining us, and also our interview with Jason Sorrell. Like I said, he wrote some of the Bill and Ted shows, produced it, really mapped out the way we all experience Halloween Horror Nights even today. So you're going to want to check that out on the next episode. And if you're looking for a good read, check out the unofficial story and guide to Halloween Horror Nights. It's written by our own Chris Ripley. It's available in all good bookstores, or you can find him on his website, hhnunofficial.com. You can also hear me on WDW Today if you want some Disney information. Go over to WDWtoday.com. But for us, visit our website, scarezone.com. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/scarezone. Follow us on Twitter at SZPodcast. And rate and review us on iTunes. Well, that's going to do it. Remember, keep your eyes closed and your ears open. We'll talk to you on the next show.
This has been a production of La 4 Brown Studios. Copyright 2016.